This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. For this episode, we're back with the theme of loneliness and a very recent guest, Julia Bainbridge, who was in our latest bonus interview as well. So definitely check that one out after this if you haven't already. For now, though, I've got a definition of loneliness to start us off from verywellmind.com. And that is that loneliness is defined by researchers as feeling lonely more than once a week. And the reason why I wanted to read this one out is because it means by that definition, I definitely experience a lot of loneliness.
Yeah, we all, by that definition, we all do, I'm sure, quite a lot. Whether or not we describe it as loneliness is a different thing, but I think we definitely all feel a disconnect potentially with others, and at least once a week potentially.
Right, and that's something that I really love about Julia's work, because she's so good at acknowledging the stigma around loneliness, that so often it's painted as a kind of personal failure. If you're feeling that, like, oh, why don't you have more friends, or why aren't you more sociable? But actually, it can be a number of reasons, including as a part of mental health struggles, you can feel increased levels of isolation, even when you're around people. That's even something I experience and do feel is strongly linked to my depression, that even when I'm with somebody that I'm really close to, sometimes I feel lonely and I miss them before they've even gone. Just when I know they're going to leave, then I start to miss them preemptively.
Aww.
I know. And a lot of people don't get that, because I'll sometimes say miss you already and they won't understand.
Aww. No, but I know what you mean. It's like when something's feeling good, there is that thing of, you know, I've had to really bring myself back a few times over the years and try and be in the moment of what's going on. Because, you know, even things like holidays, like, or doing something you're really enjoying, and it could be like, 3 days to go, and I'm like starting to get a little bit like anxious and a bit worried about returning back, and I don't want it to end, and you know, it's stopping me from enjoying being in that moment. And it's the same being with somebody, having all these thoughts that carry you away about what's going to happen at the end or when it's over. But I definitely think, you know, that's a really valid point, and I know people speak about it sometimes, but unless you really get that being lonely in a crowded room thing, unless you've really experienced that, really hard to describe how that feels.
Yeah, but I think you're right that it is quite a common thing. I mean, even just hearing you mention about holidays, like, I really felt that in my gut. Like, there's few things that kind of hit you in the way that realizing, oh, this is my last full day before we have to fly back. Yeah. Like that really creates a sinking feeling. I guess it's kind of like if you're at school, you remember it's a Sunday, and somehow in your head you thought it was a Saturday, and you're like, oh no.
Yeah. Or work, if you were a Monday to Friday worker, you know, it's that real thing, isn't it? Like, oh no, it's Sunday today, it's all over, it's back to whatever it is that you're maybe trying to avoid.
Yeah, and we're not saying that feeling in and of itself is the same as loneliness, but it's a kind of parallel where we can all feel these things to an extent. And therefore, it's extra baffling that loneliness is stigmatized. But maybe that's because it is an uncomfortable thing to talk about. And it is a reminder of how much we are reliant on other people and on our social connections. Something that we're at heightened awareness of at the moment.
Absolutely. You know, the increased Zoom and Skype calls and everything that people have got. I mean, it has interested me, because, you know, my auntie that's very isolated and lives most of her life on her own day to day. I've mentioned it on the podcast before. We've managed to get her hooked up to Zoom for some family conversations, and probably feels quite tired after it. But it did make me think, most of the time that she was on, she was always really excited and happy to hear us and see us all together, you know, her nieces and then my children and everybody being part of that and bringing life to her, really. And it has made me, you know, make a real conscious effort to make sure that I keep in touch with her better than I used to, you know, because she is and has said that she's extremely lonely.
It's a massive problem, and particularly it's a kind of intergenerational thing, that you might be lonely in one generation for very different reasons, and therefore have very different solutions to it. But particularly some of the stats that I'm looking at, you know, really concern me when it comes to loneliness in older people, because how much loneliness in and of itself can affect your physical health as well. For example, there was a study by Holt Lundstad in 2010 that found that loneliness, living alone, and poor social connections are as bad for your health as smoking 15 cigarettes a day.
Wow.
It's quite shocking, isn't it? And it's one that takes you a little bit of time maybe to wrap your head around, but I've looked into it. The research is very robust. And beyond that, there's a meta-analysis as well that found that lonely people are more likely to suffer from dementia, heart disease, and depression.
You just don't link the two together. And, you know, in general, people don't. And I remember I had a conversation with my mum even last week, who lives alone, but said she'd seen a stat and, you know, you're 3 times more likely to get dementia if you live alone. And I said, just be careful. And again, obviously, we all so pride ourselves on our stats being robust and valid. And they're not just out of, you know, we've done proper research. But it's also really important to recognise sometimes we can make assumptions about what living alone is, feels like, or what the word lonely is, or how it feels. And, you know, one person could live amongst loads of people and have a big family and feel really lonely because they can't connect to anybody in that family for whatever reason. And somebody else lives alone and loves living alone and goes out into the world and connects with people on different levels, is online and doing all sorts of things. So, you know, I did say to my mum, just be aware that, you know, living alone in itself isn't necessarily going to make you 3 times more likely to get dementia. You know, she's like, no, I know, of course I know. I'm not, you know, I know. But, you know, it's just shocking. We have to be careful with some of the stats that, you know, that we read, don't we, about what that all means. It's definitely, you know, the stat that you just read is really important for people to recognise and actually be aware of, that there are, you know, huge physical impacts actually related to loneliness.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's a good point, that it's not a permanent sentence, that yes, these stats are important to bring awareness, but that doesn't mean by any means that living alone, you're somehow written off and this is your fate. And yeah. I've, as you know, got an aunt who's a great example of the opposite, where she's the most social person I know, has more friends than anyone I've ever met, travels all the time, has a really great life that many people that actually live with families are jealous of. And yet she lives alone. But part of that is her prioritizing, making the most of that. And so absolutely, there's a lot more support that's needed. There's a lot more understanding that's needed. But by no means does this mean living alone is automatically a bad thing for somebody. And so I'm so delighted to be joined by someone that works really hard at dispelling the stigma and hosts a podcast called The Lonely Hour, which, if you've not listened to it, is incredibly reassuring and uplifting to listen to. It's quite a strange thing to realise how little this conversation is had and how reassuring it is to hear other people share their experiences of loneliness.
Absolutely. And actually something that I didn't say to Julia when we recorded with her, that in the production of it, I really enjoyed when I've listened to it, the music that she chooses, her voice, how she comes across in it. And it's a real worthwhile podcast, I would say, to listen to. And as you said, Bobby, the content is brilliant and really well put across.
And in addition to that, she's also known for being a writer. And so a lot of that real articulate intellectualism comes through in her work, that she's taking a concept that is so often overlooked and finding, much in the way we try and do with our show, all the ways in which this is linking to everyday life. You know, we take on all kinds of themes where sometimes I tell people in my life, we're doing this as our theme for the week. And it takes them a moment to think about, wait, that relates to mental health, how? And then they actually think about it and they're like, oh no, that's massive. I've never even thought about it. And so I love to see anybody trying to break down similar kind of stigma, build this kind of understanding. Also, as a quick side note, if you want to see Julia, we are working on a new filter for Instagram. So if you go and follow us on Instagram, we're at Mental Podcast. You can see our most recent guests using that filter whilst we still work on it, ready to release it to hopefully all of you. And it's something that's making me feel closer to people during this time, seeing that we are having these wonderful conversations and here are the smiling faces that go with them, when so often the restrictions of podcasting being audio can sort of take away from that. So yeah, that's a fun thing we're working on. And Julia took some really great photos. She said she had a lot of fun trying out that filter for us. So you can find those. Yeah. Oh, one last thing to mention. If you haven't voted for us in the podcast awards at podcastawards.com, you still have 2 days. You have until this Friday to do that. We won it last year for the health category. So if you can go find us in the health category, put us forward for a nomination. We may just make the top 10 again and then maybe even win it again. So fingers crossed. Thank you in advance for that. Now, I think I've said everything. So let's get into the interview with Julia all about loneliness. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
I'm Julia Bainbridge, and I think that what I'm feeling is what a lot of people are feeling right now. I don't have a daily impression of mattering to others. And I think what you and I were talking about before this, and again, I haven't meditated on this quite enough to make the link with loneliness, but having a parent who what the child perceives is choosing to drink over taking care of the child absolutely makes you feel not worth that parent's attention. And I think that that can make you feel really alone. I mean, it's a little bit cliche and obvious, but, you know, I guess that's how there's truth to it too, right? I mean, again, of course, now I know as an adult and as an adult who herself has struggled with substance use disorder that it's not necessarily a choice, meaning my mother wasn't necessarily always choosing to drink. But as a child, that's very hard to understand. And it's an action she takes. You see an active picking up of a glass and a putting it to the lips, right? And you see that happening, but not being tucked into bed at night. You know, those all feel like conscious choices. They must be, right? This is an adult parent who is ostensibly taking care of you. You know, that is the thing, as we know, that whether it makes sense or not, whether you've learned to make sense of it or not, that feeling is still way deep down inside. And that's the work in therapy, you know, to sort of undo. But that takes a long time and a lot of work.
Right. Absolutely. And also, I think even from a very young age, you have that kind of comparison. You know, you were probably seeing kids at school and getting an idea from TV what parenting was supposed to look like and then feeling you were missing parts of that.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, fast forward then to high school, I have 3 older brothers who were out of the house at this point. 2 of them went to boarding school, and then the oldest was in college. My parents were divorced, and I was taking care of my mom. I mean, I was doing the grocery shopping. I dealt with the fire department when she burned the kitchen down drunk. I called her desperately when I got in my first car accident, a very, you know, wasn't severe, but it had just started raining and the car hydroplaned and it was just a little tap, but it was still rattling. And I remember calling her and she arrived at the scene drunk. So that was useless. You know, I mean, I cooked and cleaned and kept her alive for a number of years there. And I went into school every day knowing that the experiences of my friends were quite different. I don't know what else there is to say about that.
I think you've described that really well, actually. And it does sound very lonely that you've essentially ended up in the position of being like a single parent to your mom.
Yeah, I think there's something too about being the only other woman in the family and feeling not necessarily more equipped to take care of her, because my father has certainly been excellent, you know, even long after he, quote unquote, had to be, you know, has been very present in her life. And perhaps something there about now that some of my other family members have thrown their hands up. You know, each of my brothers has children of their own and need to protect them. I don't, but I also am someone who the most recently had shared in the experience of struggling with substance. So I sort of have some more compassion for my mother now, even though closer to high school, I was so angry at her for a while, but that's morphed over the many years. And I don't know, I'm more connected to her than anyone in the family right now. And
well, that makes a lot of sense when you supported her so much. what you're describing is being a parentified child having to step up and take that role of a parent in lieu of the actual parent being able to do that. But even that experience, whilst there was other family support, can be quite isolating because it's a level of responsibility that you have and a level of understanding of your mum's mental health that can make you feel quite alone in looking after her.
Yeah, a level of responsibility that you have and yet a lack of equipment, you know, to do the job. And I think I handled it well, as any child who's asked to, you know, quote unquote, grow up quickly because they're put under those circumstances, you know, often adapts and you know, does well.
Right. Well, yeah. It's the power of human survival, isn't it? That we are able to do that even from a surprisingly young age. We'll find a way to survive and fill gaps in a family dynamic.
Yeah. But of course, as I'm sure you know more about, considering the nature of your podcast than I, you know, there are other pieces of your growth that are stunted when you devote energy to a place you're not necessarily, you know, quote unquote, supposed to at a young age.
Yeah, of course. It's not a good thing. It's just something that oftentimes when I talk to guests, I am fascinated and amazed by some of the things they've been able to achieve, even at their most challenging times. One of the things that I love so much about your work and talking about loneliness is that you recognize the stigma around it, that 100% exists, but there's not the same conversation around loneliness stigma that there is so far around mental health stigma, even though there's a lot of crossover.
It's true. I mean, that word hits like a ton of bricks. And this is coming from the girl who has a podcast called The Lonely Hour. But I remember hearing a friend of mine admit her loneliness, who's not someone I previously identified, nor I think did she herself identify as an animal person or someone who would ever, you know, be a dog mother, especially not in New York City. But she did get a dog, and I asked her why, and she just said, "I'm just so terribly lonely. You know, I controlled my facial expression to be accepting, you know, of this and supportive of her, but it was almost like my jaw dropped internally." I mean, I'd never heard anybody say that to me, admit to that, right? And that's, yeah, the stigma that we talk about. You know, it's funny, I mean, loneliness is endemic to being human, but we live in a culture where it's taboo. And that admission of loneliness both feels and is perhaps perceived as some kind of failure. If you were a more decent person, or you were somehow more likable or less broken, you would have a tribe. What does it say about you if you don't, right? So I guess what I'm trying to do in my little way is rehabilitate loneliness in order not to feel so lonely. And you know, the way in which I'm rehabilitating it is talking about it. It's not something that I wanted to put in the problem box. It's entirely normal. So could I represent this truth that is the truth, right? That everybody feels lonely. You know, everybody, no matter how successful, fabulous, beautiful, whatever you are, feels lonely at some point. Could I represent this through storytelling? Could I put this big thing into small packages, you know, episodes, right? Could there even be joy and humor in the mix, as is true to life? Right? That's what I'm trying to do. And I think another way I want to work to destigmatize loneliness is to show how we got here, how it's not really your fault. You know, I launched the show before former U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy first used the word epidemic in regards to loneliness, and before there were this, you know, Cigna and Kaiser studies. You know, with the show, I've always been exploring kind of your everyday loneliness, the kind that we all feel. But I don't deny that there is also a problem, right? And that there are some drivers of this large scale that we could do to work on, to rethink. So our placement of value on work and productivity, you know, romanticism and this idea that there's one soulmate for you out there, our idealization of individualism, and, you know, a lack of real community. I think, you know, we're designed to be interdependent. And what heals human loneliness is feeling that you have a reciprocal relationship and that you're kind of in it with another person. And I haven't, you know, quite figured out how to do that piece of the work yet. I'm not sure, but it's two-pronged, right? The ways in which I'm trying to destigmatize this. One is just cataloging people's experiences with this feeling that's very human through, you know, hopefully knock on wood, the entertaining stories on the show. And then there's the other piece of the work that is about perhaps ultimately dissecting the elements that got us to this place where loneliness is a problem and, you know, perhaps contributing to public thought in some way in that area. You know, I mean, I think as we were talking about at the beginning, in terms of my own personal experience, it was something I was feeling, something I started to notice a lot of people were also feeling, you know, that this mattering, this daily impression of mattering to others. And more people were becoming freelancers, as I think I mentioned, just the declining memberships to things, you know, of a sense of belonging, even belonging to a smaller community. You know, it's only recently that we're like living in condominiums and going into workplaces where we don't share values necessarily with, you know, our colleagues. And for most of human history, we've been operating in like groups of 20 or 30 and we work, you know, and live and die together. You know, I think there's a kind of craving for that community that I started to see, even friends of mine, even sheepishly talking about wanting to live on a commune, you know, which has, there's like, that's sort of a dirty word, but if we can maybe rethink. A lot of this too is because we value individualism and independence, right? Success, exceptionalism. We have this focus on improvement and forward motion. You know, I think that's what's driven us to work, 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 to prove our worth to others and to ourselves, you know, and we're never really satisfied. And I think, you know, the agony over that can lead to mental unwellness. I know this all seems seemingly unrelated, but I really do think it all has to do with each other. I mean, I think, what if mediocrity wasn't a dirty word? What would it look like if we valued, you know, the simple, quiet life more highly? I think we'd be happier. And I do think that there's a link between that feeling that we need to be exceptional and loneliness.
Yeah, definitely. I think you've articulated that so well. And in particular, what you've mentioned that I think is so key is this wanting of having a tribe, having connection to others. And in a way, that's perhaps becoming part of the problem, that in seeking that, we're creating more division. And, you know, social media is often used as an example of that, where we follow accounts that reinforce our view of the world, and we connect with influencers and celebrities that we feel similar to. But in doing so, we end up kind of creating this filtering where we're only seeing stuff that pleases us and goes with our values. And then we meet someone in the real world who is the opposite to that, and they seem crazy, because how can their interpretation of the facts be so different? But a lot of it is that we're getting different facts.
Absolutely. I mean, I think when we're lonely, we, of course, seek to fill the hole of belonging. And that can happen so easily through these various groups on social media, right? I mean, it can be as small as the tribe of fellow, you know, vegans, right? Like your diet as your tribe, right? And then there's like policing other people who maybe don't necessarily follow that particular diet. And you feel so strongly against the people who maybe don't subscribe to every piece of that society of vegans, right? For example, to use like a sort of light example, that a war develops over it, right? Or I think about, you can fill that hole easily through angry politics, right? I mean, people find a sense of community in the polarized tribes forming on the left and the right. I mean, in America, certainly, right? Like people locate their sense of us through the contempt peddled about them on the other side of the political spectrum. Yeah, that's a toxic kind of belonging, that it's not the real meat. It's a flimsy kind of belonging. Certainly, gosh, this pandemic, you know, has not been an equalizer in many ways. So, you know, again, speaking to my own country, like Black Americans have died in disproportionate numbers. Native Americans have been hard hit. But when I think about the politics as well, you know, broadly, you know, conservatives have pushed for economic reopening, and progressives have been more concerned about flattening the curve. And, you know, face masks have become treated as a political statement. And again, you know, I wonder, loneliness has something to do with this, you know, like needing to so vehemently stand by these certain beliefs that bind you to other people with those same beliefs.
Yeah. Well, that's the big flaw of it, isn't it? That in a way we're striving to try and find connection and find our tribe on a small level of only a select cluster of people. But in the digital age, the equivalent of that is finding a very niche tribe, maybe online, or finding people that you feel are 100% at your values. But what that neglects is the human experience. So in all this finding similar interests, what we're not finding is all the things that connect us. And that's where we end up with these crazy political battles like you're describing. And there's certainly a lot of similarity here in the UK, where something like people dying of a pandemic should be universal. We should all 100% be on the same page about this. And yet somehow it's ended up being political because we've got so used to our worldview and the way we interpret others being via quite a niche way of thinking, of finding the difference rather than finding the similarity.
Right. I saw somebody posted a poll last night on Twitter asking whether or not people believed that wearing a face mask was a political statement. And I was like, no, this is science. This is about, you know, protecting each other. I don't know yet. Anyway, I could go off on a tangent about that and how ashamed, you know, I have to say, you know, as a young journalism student, I could have never anticipated eventually interviewing somebody not from the States who would tell me that they were sorry for me because of my country. You know, I could have never anticipated that. Hey, that's a lonely feeling, I think. I think maybe perhaps being certainly the feeling that we have no real leadership right now. I think a lot of Americans feel lonely over that.
Right. Well, because in a global sense, we are in a very globalized world. And so you have unprecedented access to what other countries and people of those countries think of you. And yet America is feeling quite disconnected from the rest of the world. Britain's going through its own version of that with trying to navigate Brexit and figure out, in the broadest of senses, how connected we will be after this, what our interaction with every other country will look like. That's never really been an unknown before in the way that it is now. And to segue back to another aspect of loneliness that's really interesting and similarly baffling is how little sense the stigma makes. Because your show is a brilliant example of how, by sharing genuine experiences of loneliness, be that of yourself or of guests, it's incredibly connecting. That if the answer to loneliness for many people might be as simple as hearing that other people are experiencing it too, then it makes it even more baffling that we're not doing that.
Vulnerability is the root of connection. And when you dare to be honest, sharing flaws or concerns, that's when, for example, a real friendship begins. That's the foundation, right? So I think you're absolutely right.
And perhaps that's the actual connection we're seeking, not finding our tribe, but feeling more connected to the world, feeling less isolated, because isolation isn't about necessarily having nobody. It's a feeling of being cut off. It's even broader than how many people you might find are in your tribe, but instead it's about being in Congress with the world, in a way. Would you agree?
Well, yeah, that's interesting. I mean, when I think about defining loneliness, right, like it's subjective, it's a feeling, right? A feeling that we don't have enough social connection in our life. When I think about isolation, that's an objective measure of how many people we have around us. And what we're talking about, what matters, is what you feel, right? There's like aloneness, which is a state, right? Loneliness, I think of as sort of a sad feeling over that state. And then solitude has a kind of more positive bent, right? It's something we seek. I'm going a little off topic, but when I think about loneliness versus isolation.
Yeah, you're right. Well, it's so nuanced and it can be so confusing because how do we quantify emotion? That's so difficult. And it's a conversation that often comes up with mental health as well, that many of the symptoms of mental ill health are feelings. And it's like, but how do you quantify that? If symptoms of mental ill health are feelings that any of us can feel depending on our circumstances, then are these not part of the human experience in the same way loneliness is? How can we possibly stigmatize something that is at least briefly a part of everyone's experience at some point?
Right, but the stigma is also what makes it so hard to study, right? So, I mean, I know there is like a UCLA loneliness scale, and you know there are ways in which people are trying to measure loneliness to figure out to what degree it really is increasing in our modern age. But it's hard because people might not report honestly because, again, there's this stigma. I think that's hard with any kind of mental health issue, right?
100%. And like you mentioned earlier on, what that means in terms of our identity, even just talking about loneliness openly, if the people around you aren't comfortable with that conversation, or maybe just not even used to having it at all, an instinct to that, because of the stigma, may be to pull away. So you expressing your loneliness could cause people to isolate you further.
Conversely, I wonder what you've been seeing, perhaps, in terms of online specifically, people coming together around these mental health issues. I see some of these, you know, this is, I'm showing my age here, but some of these like young, like TikTok kids, you know, creating personalities around their anxiety, around, you know, I mean, even bringing some of these mental health issues into a kind of comedic, quote unquote, show in their own way, normalizing these things. Have you seen any of that? I'm thinking of like Lele Pons, who's this big TikTok star who, you know, does very like funny physical comedy, but a lot of it is about neediness and attachment to her friends. And there's something going on there that might be healthy. Maybe it's unhealthy, I don't know, to identify too strongly and make make your mental illness so much of your identity. I don't know. Do you have any feelings on this? Or are you observing the same thing?
I definitely am. I'm definitely seeing that. And you're right, it is quite difficult because on one hand, it can be incredibly empowering and unifying. You know, it's no coincidence that many people that listen to the podcast feel very connected to me because of how openly I speak about a lot of my own issues, and I'm very honest about them. And so many experiences of mental health struggles are quite universal. Even if you've not experienced them to the same degree, or maybe you've experienced a different condition than I have, there is so much crossover. And so I think it can be incredibly uniting, and absolutely reducing stigma around mental illness is a part of reducing loneliness and isolation. It's very intertwined, but at the same time, you're right, it can cause problems if that becomes your whole identity. Mm-hmm. And then maybe even people expect you to always struggle. And I think anxiety in particular is very like that, that people anticipate you to have constant anxiety, which when it's well managed, it will generally become more circumstantial on what's happening, mm-hmm. rather than being this kind of constant buzz that people can experience when they're really, really struggling with it. You know, maybe other people sort of inhibit that growth, perhaps. If they're constantly treating you as an anxious person, they're sort of putting you in this box where you need to remain for them to continue understanding you.
Yeah, especially if I could see that happening with just private interpersonal relationships, but especially if it's part of your brand. Yeah, the expectation that you perform that illness in a way.
Yeah, that's the bit which really concerns me, that people may feel they can't grow beyond that. Or there's other cases, like it's very common for people to be re-diagnosed with a different condition. And so if part of what people know you for being your mental health and maybe a specific diagnosis, then who does that mean you are if your diagnosis changes? And also on a personal level, the coming to terms with that, if you've spent years coming to terms with a particular condition as your diagnosis, and then it turns out it wasn't that, it was like bipolar, for example, which is often misdiagnosed, then that's a whole soul searching of how does this change who I am? I've already done so much to overcome this stigma, and now I need to do it again in a different area.
Yeah, I noticed in my previous response how unfortunately deep the stigma is, that even a girl with a show on loneliness starts to giggle when discussing these issues as a way to, I don't know, what's the function of laughing? You know, I guess discomfort, right? You giggle because you're uncomfortable with the topic.
Yeah, it can be like an anxiety release in a way, yeah. That it's a topic you maybe feel a bit uncomfortable around, and so it's a way to alleviate that.
Yeah, how funny. I just noticed and felt like I should share what I'm noticing.
Yeah, no, that's very self-aware of you. And then in starting to wrap up our conversation about loneliness, with all the work you've done around it, with all the research and the brilliant conversations you've had through your podcast, what kind of ways do you see people overcoming this?
It's not necessarily about overcoming it. What I've learned through the stories that have been shared are that there are merits to loneliness, merits to even this. Obviously, there are merits to solitude or alone time. You know, I certainly, as a writer, need lots of alone time too. Any creative person, I think, I'm sure yourself as well, right? That's when a lot of those synapses are firing and the work gets done. But loneliness, even that sad feeling, it's where we change. It's where we grow and develop. I think somebody who has been very influential is poet and philosopher David White. And he has this way of inverting the common understanding of something to reveal often a counterintuitive but deeper meaning. He talks about loneliness as a doorway to becoming, right? It's a difficult doorway. It's vulnerable. It's one you don't necessarily want to go through. But what it does is simplify life. And it brings us down to this foundational understanding of, you know, what is the simplest thing I need and want in life? So, you know, he would say, try to see loneliness as a foundation for understanding yourself and then stepping off of it. And I would say, put loneliness there, right? Loneliness, it's a necessary clearing of the space. We shouldn't be in this like binary mode of trying to cure loneliness in order to be socially cemented to others, but to see it in a kind of, he often talks about a seasonal way, you know, that it's necessary for every human being to go through thresholds of deep loneliness at crucial stages in their life. And if they didn't, they wouldn't change. And I would say that's true. You know, I reference him because he synthesizes it all so much better than I. But I went back to my episodes and looked at each story, and that's true. You know, loneliness told people where they needed to go.
There can be answers in discomfort, and that kind of non-linear thinking can be quite uncomfortable. It's mm-hmm. It's so much more tempting to label some things as good, label other things as bad. And that's not really the world we live in. But to share a bit of my experience of loneliness, that yeah. was something that I understood perhaps more than I understood mental illness when I was very little. So I interpreted early symptoms of depression as loneliness because that's the closest thing that I understood. And so actually, in a way, a lot of these feelings of loneliness that I felt through my life have been the times where I've been doing the most self-reflection. And it's a strange thing to describe something that's a symptom of mental ill health as part of the way that I overcame it. That fits outside of this good and bad narrative. But it's my truth. It's what I experience, that part of the drawing away from the world that was part of my depression was also some of where I found the answers in myself of what is my formula to happiness right. and to overcoming this discomfort. And maybe there's times when now I still feel lonely, but it's appropriate. You know, it makes sense. I miss people and it reminds me how much I care about them. And so in yeah. that way, there can be such positive, even if it's something that we can still be overwhelmed by. And so there's that negative as well, maybe more like a spectrum.
Yeah, that's beautifully put. I think the way you felt about it as a child, confusing the two, right? Loneliness and depression remains for a lot of people into adulthood. It's hard, you know, there's overlap. It's kind of hard to pull them apart, right? And when I think about what loneliness feels like, you know, it's that not belonging, that sense of being unanchored, that you won't really be seen by someone the way you want to be. You won't be found by the world in the way that you want to be. And that's a depressing notion, right? So it's, yeah, they are intertwined. I'm glad you've found a way to make your formula make good sense to you.
Thank you. And then one thing I want to just wrap up with then in terms of your own experience, and particularly what we talked about around alcoholism, to what extent do you feel loneliness can inhibit recovery with that condition? Or do you feel like there are some elements of positive within the interactions there as well?
Yeah, I mean, look, isolation is the enemy of recovery. I think a lot of people who really deeply struggle with substance use disorder rely on community to stay the course. And meetings are going on, of course. You know, they've shifted to virtual meetings, but there's And I'm impressed with that. I'm impressed with the ways that people have immediately found to connect and adapt to this new normal. But there's something lacking, even painful, about Zoom and FaceTime. You know, I mean, you connect, but you're simultaneously experiencing loss, you know, loss of touch, of course, which we know keeps stress levels down, but also loss of facial cues and body language, you know, silence even. Yeah, this all becomes harder. And when you hang up, you're left with this reminder or realization that we aren't going to be able to do this in person for a very long time. And I think, you know, there's so much about being in person with people. If I think specifically about meetings, like just seeing other people nod as you're speaking, you know, that kind of validation, you can, you know, without anyone speaking, you can see someone in the corner, maybe even, you know, exhaling or, you know, expressing something that communicates to you that they know what you're talking about and you feel a sense of solidarity with them. Thusly, that all becomes impossible with the virtual meetings. And then, of course, there are a lot of people who really rely on meetings like AA, which are free, you know, people living below the poverty line who struggle with this, who don't have access to the internet. And so for those people, I'm concerned about a lot of people slipping back into their addictions, you know. And I don't know if that was quite what you were asking, but that's what comes up when you say that. Yeah.
No, I think that's really well phrased. And you've highlighted there what can be very disingenuous about this form of communication, that to me it is fundamentally performative. You are aware of what you look like by the little you in the corner, and you are looking at everyone's face at the same time, and you maybe feel a pressure to interact with everyone and speak more than you might do otherwise, because you're very aware of being in this structured conversation that technology creates. And then at the end, don't goodbye hug, you just press hang up. And even that is quite sudden, a cutoff. And I think what it creates, particularly in situations like potentially AA, is a kind of disconnection from genuine feeling. That what about the person in the meeting that doesn't want to speak that day, that isn't feeling up to it? They just want to sit and listen. And that is them genuinely expressing how they're doing.
Silence is really powerful. Sharing silence with someone in person can be really powerful. Exactly what you say about this form of conversation, you know, that silence becomes harder when you feel like you're meant to perform, which is, yes, I feel something that happens when connecting this way versus in person. And if I go back to thinking about the meetings, you know, at the end, there's time to mill about and check in on an individual, right? Like there's often, everybody's having a little bit of coffee, you know, the official meeting has ended, but you're all, maybe you thank somebody for having shared that day, or you notice the person who's new and who was sitting there silent and looked a little scared. You go over to them and just check in and maybe offer to be a sponsor if they need it, or that can't happen over Zoom.
Definitely. And so that's something that in all of this reflecting during the pandemic, I really hope that we're reminded of that, of how important it is. Like I mentioned earlier, being reminded of missing people by being away from them. And that can be very powerful in building connection. Maybe if you were around even some of the closest people in your life, 24, in fact, I'm not even going to say maybe, definitely if I was around many of the people I'm closest to in my life 24/7, that would really negatively affect our relationships.
Mm-hmm. The longer we go without human interaction, the further frayed our social bonds become. Yeah, I mean, social connection, it helps us address challenges we face, you know, as individuals and a society. And I'm concerned about, you know, also how easy we've discovered connection can be, although maybe it's not the real connection, but right, like as opposed to me getting on the subway to go uptown to the 92nd Street to watch in person with a crowd, you know, some author that I love being interviewed by, you know, some journalist I love, I can just sign on and see it online. And I wonder if we're going to, I mean, perhaps it's no point in wondering and borrowing trouble, right? But it's so much easier to do that and, you know, log in and out and watch that conversation in your sweatpants for only an hour, which is the time of the actual talk, than 3 hours that it would take me to get, you know, there from Brooklyn, see the talk, come back. But there's so much we miss when we're not in community with each other in that way, right? Does that make sense? Maybe that's where that other piece of my work will come in. Maybe I'll have to be a social connection warrior.
I love that. All right, so we will wrap up there. I'm so grateful for you coming on and covering this really important topic with us.
Thank you so much. Thanks for doing the work you're doing.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.